It's just gone 10 o'clock and now Free Thinking with Rana Mitter.
Thank you, Jonathan. And this evening on Free Thinking, we hear that when chronic pain hits your brain, you should let the latest developments in neuroscience take the strain, with a little help from ancient techniques of meditation. Psychiatrist Norman Doidge helps us to heal later on. But if your pain is more acute, coming from a secret policeman and his flying truncheon hitting your tender parts, then you may need advice from Srdja Popovic, the man who used Gandhian tactics to bring down Serbian dictator Slobodan Milosevic, and who's now in Britain with his own blueprint for revolution. We'll hear his bullet points later. Non-violent bullets, of course. Now, in the film Manhattan, Woody Allen gives his considered view of non-violent protest, and he ain't convinced. Bricks and baseball bats really get right to the point, he argues. Physical force is always better with Nazis, because it's hard to satirize a guy with shiny boots on. Well, one person who disagrees with that, I won't say violently disagrees, is Srdja Popovic. Now, if you don't know his name, you'll certainly know his work. He was one of the masterminds behind Otpor, the protest movement that brought Serbian dictator Slobodan Milosevic to his knees in the year 2000. With street protests that combine the tactics of carnival with the single-mindedness of military strategy. Since then, Popovic has become the go-to guy on non-violent resistance around the world, from Tahrir Square in Cairo to the Maidan in Kiev. And he's now published a how-to guide entitled Blueprint for a Revolution, a sort of 10-step checklist to toppling dictators while sometimes having some fun along the way. Srdja joins me now down the line from Bristol, and with me in the studio I have the historian and political commentator Kate Maltby. And Srdja, you and your movement Otpor were central to the fall of Milosevic back then in 2000. What do you think was the most important non-violent tactic that you used that really made a difference?
Well, first of all, good evening and pleasure being on BBC program. And as you pointed, we combined a really cool strategy and really serious military approach to this struggle, like, you know, just not using arms, with a hilarious humor. And I think if there is one thing the Serbian movement was well known was our commitment to doing humorous public actions. And one of the stories I love to tell is the story from the very beginning, where we were just a small group of people, but really into the spirit of mocking the dictator and doing the thing the, let's say, Monty Python way, because I hear we are sharing this passion for Monty Python.
We certainly are, yes. And Woody Allen.
And Woody Allen, of course, who was big in our growing up. So imagine the big petrol barrel with a photo of beautiful Slobodan Milosevic on it, posted on the main Belgrade shopping district, our own version of Bond Street. And there is a little hole, so you can really put a little coin and buy yourself a right to hit the face of beloved president on the petrol barrel with a baseball bat. Well, this is loud, and of course, it attracts people walking by. And, you know, we just leave that barrel there, you go there, you have an espresso and watch the development of the events. And within the range of 10 minutes, there is a line of about 57 people ready to play a little bit with beloved Mr. President. Well, you know, we are sitting there having fun, but that's not the funniest part. The funniest part is when police arrive, because one of the things we look at the book and one of the things a successful movement do, they're putting their opponent in a dilemma action. So if you're a policeman, what would you do? Arrest us. We are nowhere to be seen. Arrest downtown shoppers and accuse them for what? That makes no sense. You can bet that they've done the most stupid things. They arrested the barrel with Milosevic's face. So now we have two police persons bringing the barrel with Milosevic's face into the police cars while the newspaper journalists are having the best afternoon of their week. So these simple actions, these simple dilemma actions, and specifically use of humor in mobilization, but mocking your bigger-than-life opponent, is the tactics which was really Otpor's trademark back there in 90s in Serbia. So yes, humor can be used to dismantle the bad guys.
Could you take a moment, Srdja, just to analyze that a bit for us? Because I mean, this vision of someone with a baseball bat smashing a picture of Milosevic on an oil barrel, I have to say that, you know, at least it's sort of violence by metaphor, but I suppose it's not literal violence. But why do you think that made a difference in the specific case of Serbia in 2000? Why was it an effective tactic then and there?
Well, I think the humor specifically, and especially the thing we call laughtivism, which is intentional use of political mocking, whether you're using the barrel with Milosevic's face or you're using now famous toy protests, which were banned in Russia by Mr. Putin in 2012, or you look at Egypt and
other places.
Those
are the protests using Lego figures rather than humans.
Yes. So this, which is why the Lego figures are subtitle of the book. Let me explain this a little bit. Of course, banned protests in Russia, but the people can still organize their toys to protest. Why
are these tactics successful, though, do you think? I mean, what is it that makes them
humor
work?
Humor is really important power. And when you look at the nonviolent tactics, you can say, you know, that they have a different purposes. But humor is particularly interesting, and we look at it throughout the world because of three reasons. First, humor destroys fear. And I mean, if you are preparing for the major surgery, the last thing you want to hear is how the surgery want to go. The first thing you want to hear is a good joke, because, you know, it relieves you a bit. Second, humor adds a cool factor to the movement, because naturally the people who are funny, the people who can make you laugh, are the centers for attraction. And yes, the movements who can be funny and pranky attracts a lot of cool people. Last but not of least importance, people in power, Milosevic included, but also the democratically elected leaders, when they spend too much time in their office, they tend to take themselves too seriously. So often faced with mocking activities, they tend to do stupid things, and there become the punchline for new wave of jokes.
Okay, so Sergio, I'm going to bring in Kate Maltby, who's here in the studio, and say, Kate, you work in perhaps the slightly more staid and perhaps less humour-filled world of democratic politics on occasion, you know, sort of political thinking and so forth here in the UK. Does this sound like a set of ideas that's transferable to the world that you know?
Well, actually, I think it's very transferable to the world of UK politics. I'm not so convinced that it's transferable to really autocratic dictatorships around the world. My problem with Sergio's handbook, and may I say it's a pleasure to be talking to you precisely because I think it is a fantastic book and it should be essential reading, but I'm afraid my concern is that it only seems, laughtivism only seems to work in dictatorships that are already porous.
Laughtivism, by the way, is Sergio's word for activism through humour. I should just explain
yes,
that.
Yes, and it's a great idea, and it is this idea that laughtivism is the activity of just creating laughter in the streets, of making people laugh at dictators. And that's all well and good, but you talk, for example, about the fact that Milosevic's policemen knew that they couldn't arrest every shopper who'd lined up to smash that barrel on a street. Well, I've spent a lot of time this year talking to Syrian refugees, and I'm convinced that if you tried that trick in Assad's Syria before the uprising started, that's a society in which policemen simply would go around and arrest everybody on the street. This is only possible when there is a pretense, at least a facade, of a democratic liberal society underneath the dictatorship.
I mean, that's an important difference, isn't it, Shirja? I mean, Bashar al-Assad is not a guy who's going to be very sympathetic to these kind of gags that you're pulling. You have to have at least the facade of a democratic society, as happened in Serbia during the time that you were there.
Well, I would say that the humor was a very important part of the show in Syria, and disagree at least three points. First, you can go on YouTube and look at the Top Goon, which is the Syrian version of Spitting Image, and that's a home puppet show, really low risk. So if you're facing the oppressive regime, yes, you can mock it. What you want to avoid is people in the street getting in touch with the police. So the activists in Syria were finding the way to dig their leftivism. One of the things they did is a home puppet show, which is really cool and popular. It was done in a basement in Damascus. Nobody got hurt, and the people were still laughing out loud on Assad. Second, the Syrians, and that can be look in Everyday Rebellion, the really cool movie about the creative activism, have done another great thing. You know, these songs, they have these songs, "We Were Provoking Assad," and Assad was super crazy about listening to these songs. Well, imagine these songs tied to the small transistors and hit in the garbage cans with a timer. So immediately, simultaneously, from 50 to 100 garbage cans, here come the forbidden song. There are no people to be arrested, people are away, but now the police need to dig through these garbage cans to find these little transmitters and destroy them, and they still look ridiculous. So picking the tactic which will expose less people to risk is a very clever thing, which is where I'm going to agree with you completely.
Yes.
But using a humor is not limited to soft dictators. Even the hard dictators can become the victims of humor.
Well, Sergio, let me move away from the tactics to the results, because one thing's very notable about most of the cases that you cite, South Africa, Serbia, you mentioned Poland, and we still have Krzysztof Zanussi here in the studio, of course, knows all about socialist Poland. But the thing that unites them, it seems to me, all your case studies, is that they're people like us. In other words, liberal, democratic, pluralist people seeking to overthrow dictators. And probably most people listening to this programme can get behind that idea. They're easy to sympathise with. What about cases where we find that's harder? Like the Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran, who came to power in 1979 through entirely peaceful mass protest, but then used that to create a highly non-liberal regime. I mean, these non-violent tactics don't have to be used in the service of liberalism, do they?
Well, I mean, these are two great assumptions. First, I mean, who is making these revolutions? And one of the things we claim in the book that it is all about hobbits. And when you really look at the heroes,
as in Tolkien.
As in Tolkien, my favorite personal religion. And I mean, hobbits are not the best suitable people to fight dictators or win against Sauron. They don't know magic.
But what if your hobbits are hobbits and they're small people, but they're not liberals, as in Iran in 1979?
Well, I mean, they still can be opposed by the same methodology. But I think the grand lesson here is the very nature of nonviolent struggle is in pulling the middle of the society to your side.
But this isn't about opposing the non-liberal hobbits when they get into the power. What happens when your non-liberal hobbits, or shall we say the reactionaries, use laughterism against liberal societies? I mean, I'm thinking about Europe at the moment. We see, we're looking at serious unrest pretty much across the whole, every country facing elections this year in Europe is seeing reactionary parties, is seeing very, very strong populist movements, which frankly whose greatest strength is mocking the establishment. Sometimes liberal establishments can be a good thing, can't they?
I mean, isn't that the case, Shridhar? Sometimes it is, in fact, about uncomfortable alliances. I mean, I think again about your case of Serbia. In 1999, NATO bombed the city of Belgrade in a highly violent manner, and yet that was an important first point for your non-violent movement a year later, wasn't it?
No, it was the down point and one of the strongest mistakes the international community ever made. In fact, when you read the book, you'll understand that, this opposition to the foreign attack is something which really boosts dictators. And this is like George W. Bush having
sure,
the highest ratings on 9/11.
Sure, but then what can Western countries do?
Can I answer one question after another? And I mean, so one thing is avoid foreign military intervention, and this doesn't lead to peace. And I was the happiest person in the world where this crazy idea of bombing Libya was fell down in a British parliament. And I'm hoping to the world where we are not going to look more and more military interventions. And you're right, the foreigners can do stuff. And I mean, if you want to fix things...
And don't we have
a
moral responsibility? I mean, it's very difficult to tell us that we simply can't get involved in toppling a dictator.
Of course, you should get involved in promoting great ideas and great values. But if your only toolbox are bombs.